From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
It's election season. Primary election day in Florida is this Tuesday. We'll talk about which candidates are leading the pack.
It's not really a question of who's going to win the primary. It's more of a question of who is going to get second place in the primary.
Also this week, Florida has what's called a closed primary. That's causing frustration for some NPA voters.
There is a growing movement to address and change that system. There's organizations generally led by independent voters who, again, want to have a greater say.
We'll also hear about efforts to improve community resilience and protect against flooding in Florida's inland communities. And we'll talk about a new law that lets students take marching band for their PE credit. I'm Regan McCarthy, on air and online. This is Capitol Report and our end-of-the-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Florida's primaries on Tuesday feature a crowded Republican governor's field with a clear frontrunner and contests between moderate and progressive Democrats across the state. WFSU's Tristan Wood and Tampa Bay Times Tallahassee Bureau reporter Liv Caputo break down those races.
I know a lot of the coverage from some of the outlets in Florida have projected Byron Donalds as the frontrunner. Do you think that's changed at all going into these primaries on Tuesday?
I mean, he's more than just a frontrunner. It's one of these unusual races where you have a candidate who is so far ahead in so many polls, 20, 30 points ahead of the second place candidate. The most interesting thing about the race right now is this kind of race for second place. We're seeing between Jay Collins, the lieutenant governor, and James Fishback, an investor, online provocateur. And you're seeing this race to see who can get maybe 15, 16% of the electorate. Now, Byron is consistently polling between 30 to 45 points. It's just, or 30 to 45% of the vote currently in polls. Whereas Fishback and Collins are polling around 10 to 12%, 8 to 12 maybe. So it's not really a question of who's going to win the primary. It's more of a question of who is going to get second place in the primary.
Yeah, absolutely. And it kind of seems that way from kind of the responses you're getting from the Democratic side of it. I know Democratic Lieutenant Governor candidate Gwen Graham, when I spoke with her on Florida A&M University's campus yesterday, she was looking ahead at running against Byron Donalds and messaging about Byron Donalds. So they seem to at least be like looking forward to that general election matchup.
For sure. I mean, I think the Donalds campaign has already challenged the Jolly campaign to multiple debates, and they did this days before the primary, before the primary is supposed to happen. So they know Jolly's the front runner because it's really only him in that race. And then the Jolly campaign knows that it's going to be Byron. We haven't had such a big lead like this in a little while in terms of a primary. So everyone kind of knows who the nominees are going to be, and that's what everyone's looking forward to.
Gotcha there. Transitioning to another one of these kind of top of ticket primary races that was getting attention. The only one that's like really getting attention had the primaries is the Florida Senate Democrat matchup between Alex Vindman and Angie Nixon. What do you make of that race?
I think it's getting some attention because you have the more moderate candidate in Vindman, and then you have the much more progressive candidate in Nixon, which is interesting. Again, though, talking about voter registration and Republican versus Democrat, it's going to be hard for whoever that nominee is to take on Ashley Moody. Again, that would be a really big upset if a Democrat was able to win in that race. A Democrat has not won statewide in a very long time. I think 2018 was the last time with Nikki Fried for ag commissioner. So again, it's going to be hard for a Democrat to win at the top of the ticket.
Got you there. And internally in that race, I mean, I think one of the reasons it's getting attention is because of kind of that moderate versus progressive candidate trend that we've seen play out in other states around the country, whether it be Wisconsin, Michigan, New York. But unlike those races that are, you know, largely pretty close, polling suggests that Alex Vindman is the front runner in that race by a large margin. Why do you think that is in Florida?
Florida is interesting. Both like we've been talking about, and how many more Republicans exist than Democrats, but also in terms of the type of Democrats we have. We in Florida try to, especially in South Florida, veer away a little bit from overly progressive ideas. Republicans were very successful in this state a few years ago, branding different Democrats as socialists or communists. And those are really loaded words for a lot of immigrants in South Florida who fled communist or socialist countries. So I think it could be a little bit harder for a candidate like that to win, especially in South Florida. Then again, South Florida only makes up about 20% of the electorate, anyways. So it's going to come down to who is able to energize more voters, who is able to energize turnout, and who has the most important message for Floridians.
Gotcha. And kind of with these Democratic primaries, kind of that progressive versus more moderate candidate dynamic is playing out in several of the South Florida congressional races this cycle. The one that comes to two that come to mind for me is Florida's 20th congressional district, where you have Elijah Manley and several other candidates versus Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And in the 25th congressional district, you have Democratic Socialists of America backed Oliver Larkin versus Congressman Jared Moskowitz. What do you make of those battles playing out in these primaries in these South Florida districts?
Really interesting to see. I mean, like we said before, and this is not to say progressives are all socialists or progressives or anything like that, but they sometimes that's where Republicans feel most comfortable attacking, and that's where they feel their message can really stick. So again, we're talking about the primaries right now. So if we take the Republican factor out of it and just look at, for example, Oliver Larkin and Jared Moskowitz, that'd be interesting. I mean, Moskowitz is an incumbent, but his district has been redrawn to include a more Republican electorate. So, I mean, I would be surprised if someone backed by the DSA was able to pull out a win in that district. But again, it's Florida. Florida's weird. Stuff happens. So, who knows? I mean, it'll be definitely interesting to keep an eye on, though.
The interesting thing about the redraw for me especially is with the district that Moskowitz is running in Florida's 25th, it was redrawn to have like a strip running up the coastline there, which if you know anything about South Florida politics, one of the things that has made that district more Republican leaning is you've seen a bit of a ideological flip in who's living in kind of the condos and more wealthier areas along Florida's coastline down there. You've seen it shift remarkably from more blue leaning in pre-Trump years to a lot more red in Trump years. So it would be interesting, even if Larkin somehow won as a DSA candidate in that race, how he would fare in a heavily in a more Republican leaning district.
Again, I mean, the most interesting thing to keep an eye on here is we're seeing throughout the country, you're seeing these more progressive candidates becoming more and more popular, doing better and better in different races. Can that happen in Florida? That's the real question. And I think that's something that people should really keep an eye on Tuesday to see in these races, like you mentioned, in the South Florida races, because that's where we're seeing most of it.
Thank you so much, Liv, for your time. I really appreciate it.
Of course, thanks so much for having me.
That was WFSU's Tristan Wood speaking with Tampa Bay Times reporter Liv Caputo. While there are plenty of local races to vote on in the primary election, some voters are realizing after receiving their mail-in ballots that for the state races, Florida has a closed primary system. In recent years, Florida has seen an influx of residents from states with less restrictive systems determining who can vote in primary elections. They may find Florida's system a bit confusing. WGCU's Teddy Byrne and John Davis discuss the difference between a closed and an open primary election.
John, the closed primary system is older than many people might realize. How far back does it go?
Well, here in Florida, it goes back to 1913. That's when they adopted a law creating a system where only registered Republicans vote in Republican primaries and vice versa for Democrats. But this was long before the modern Republican versus Democratic system that we have now. This was a system that was adopted during the Progressive era. It was really more about party integrity at the time. And even before we had primary elections, it was officials within their parties who would choose who their nominees for different political contests were going to be in conferences or caucuses. So when they started letting voters choose who the party's nominee was going to be, you can understand how letting just any voter, regardless of party affiliation, would feel untenable. That law did remain on the books, but it really kind of became codified in 1968. And that's when Florida adopted a new constitution, replacing an outdated constitution from 1885. But the one that we have now set up the election system that we have now in the current closed primary system. By the end of the 20th century, Florida was one of the small number of states that still used primary elections this way, had this restrictive closed system. And then in 1998, voters approved a constitutional amendment, the Universal Primary Amendment. And this opened the completely closed primary system to what we actually have today, where let's say you're a registered Republican and there are no Republicans in that race or any other candidates in that race, regardless of party affiliation, you would still get to have a voice in that primary, even though no candidates of your party affiliation were in it. And again, that's the system that we have now.
What are the arguments for opening up the primaries or keeping it closed?
I think the major argument for keeping it the way it is now is this idea that Republicans should choose the Republican nominee and Democrats should choose the Democratic nominee. Supporters of the current system also point out that opening up primaries could open up the election system to what is called raiding. Let's say you have five Republican candidates that are competing for the nomination. Democratic voters could theoretically then vote in the Republican they think is the weakest and would have the least chance of defeating the Democrat. I don't think that argument is that strong because people already do a version of that today. If you are a Democrat and you live in a heavily Republican area, there are people who will choose to register with the party that they don't actually agree with just so that they can have a greater say in the elections of officials that are going to be governing them. As far as arguments to open up the primaries, the idea is that this is a taxpayer-funded process for determining our elected officials, and as many eligible voters as possible should have a say in that process. And this is where we get into the strongest argument of how independent voters are really disenfranchised from this process. Because you're not registered Republican or Democrat, there's much less on your primary ballot that you're going to be able to vote on. And the number of independents in Florida, as people become more disenfranchised with the Republican and Democratic parties, means that this is a much larger voter block. In 2000, the number of NPA registered voters in Florida made up about 15.5% of the overall electorate. Today, it's nearly a quarter. So there's a lot more people who are not getting to have a say in these primary political contests today than there were even just a quarter century ago.
One of the biggest arguments against maintaining the current system is the write-in loophole. What exactly is that?
Let's say you only have Republicans running for a race. There are no Democrats. That would open up the primary under the current system that we have. But if you have a write-in candidate who then qualifies, now the primary becomes closed again because whoever wins that primary is going to face a competitor in the general election. This came out of a 2000 interpretation written by then Secretary of State Katherine Harris, where she basically stated, if there is a write-in candidate, the way we interpret the law means that closes the primary again. So what this creates is a system that really seems to benefit incumbents. In Florida, lawmakers tend not to want to fix this system because they benefit from it. And I'm not talking Republicans over Democrats. In more left-leaning state legislative districts, the opposite is true. Democrats will use the write-in loophole to their benefit. Both parties do it. But there is a growing movement to address and change that system. There's organizations generally led by independent voters who, again, want to have a greater say and to bring more attention to the system and the disenfranchisement of independent voters. But as far as any change getting made, I don't see the legislature doing that anytime soon. I think if that's going to happen, it's going to be through the citizen ballot initiative.
That was WGCU's Teddy Byrne and John Davis. Speaking of the primaries, early voting is underway. Floridians are headed to the polls while election supervisors across the state are focused on ensuring elections can go off without a hitch. Leon County Supervisor of Elections Mark Early joined the Between the Lines with Dara Kam podcast from State Affairs to explain why combating distrust in the voting process is the greatest challenge facing today's supervisors.
What about safety of election workers? That's something we've heard about before. You know, after the 2020 election, we had folks quitting, not here in town, but supervisors retiring, saying, you know, it's just throwing up their hands. It's not worth the hassle.
Certainly the emotional environment working in elections has changed. It's always been, you know, a feel-good celebration of patriotism really to work in the elections field. And it still is, but it's definitely more fraught. The tensions out there, the emotional levels of the voters, all of this talk about how you can't trust what we do. You know, we're your neighbors, we're your family members. We live in the communities that we serve, and I know elections officials from all over the country, and every single one I would call a super patriot. They are in it to protect democracy and serve their communities and their nation, and that's what we do. We have great passion for it, especially those that have stuck around. But since 2020, I know we've had more than 50% turnover in supervisors' elections in Florida.
Wow.
And really that carries across the nation. Some states it's much greater than that. So, you know, that leads to concerns about, you know, lack of that institutional knowledge. One thing I can reassure voters, at least here in Florida, you know, we paid our dues in 2000. We really professionalized our association. We've got great training. We've got a Master Florida Certified Election Professional. Really, it's like a degree. There's 30 courses, 4 hours each, that are taught by elections professionals. And it's a really high degree of training.
That was the Leon County Supervisor of Elections, Mark Early, on the Between the Lines with Dara Kam podcast from State Affairs. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up on Capitol Report, a new rule about secondary locks on classroom doors is raising questions.
No school in their right mind is going to hand out all their master keys.
And a new law lets high school students earn a PE credit for participating in marching band.
They learn what it means to have grit and be able to push through your comfort zone. So, you know, is something uncomfortable or is it actually pain, right?
Florida lawmakers passed a bill last year allowing public school classrooms to use secondary locks in the event of a shooting. WUSF's Douglas Soule reports a lock company is accusing state education officials of using regulations to restrict what lawmakers allowed.
Nightlock makes small, strong door barricades. Co-owner Jack Taylor says hundreds of Florida schools, mostly private ones, already use them.
They're a simple device, very economical. It goes down at the bottom of the door, and if there's an armed intruder alert, the teachers or the students can lock down.
The Florida Department of Education unsuccessfully pushed lawmakers to repeal the secondary lock provision this year. It then developed a rule with several new requirements, including one that says every potential first responder has to have master keys. State Board of Education Chair Ryan Petty says otherwise, the locks could delay life-saving response to classrooms.
If you choose to use these, which I would ask you again to reconsider whether or not you do this, but if you do, these restrictions and rules will minimize the loss of life.
Nightlock's co-owner, Jack Taylor, says schools already have systems to get first responders into locked classrooms and says giving away so many keys creates its own risks.
Because they want the schools to hand out the master keys to hundreds of first responders. And no school in their right mind is going to hand out all their master keys.
Nightlock says education officials went too far, tried to get around the legislature, and didn't follow proper rulemaking procedures. The company's challenging the rule. An administrative hearing is set for next week. I'm Douglas Soule in Tallahassee.
We're a few months into what's been a quiet hurricane season. Normally, we would be entering the peak of the season, and many Floridians might be thinking about flooding. And not just on the coast. Inland communities have faced catastrophic floods in recent years. But an 8-month investigation by WUFT's Rose Schnabel found that a state flood resilience program spends almost all of its dollars on the coast.
After a big storm, you've likely heard the headlines.
An inland community flooded after swollen rivers were overwhelmed by the storm.
It's going to take up to a year to recover from some of the damage we saw from this flooding.
And these headlines aren't from Tampa or Miami. They're from communities more than 40 miles from the coast. But they faced devastating floods in the past 5 years. Climate change is raising flood risks on coasts and inland. That's according to Carrie Cook, a professor who studies climate at the University of Texas at Austin.
Storms are getting stronger and they deliver more water per minute, for example, and this can increase flooding for sure.
Historically, Florida has focused a lot of its flood resilience efforts on the coasts. But in 2021, the state legislature created a program meant to help inland communities, too. It's called Resilient Florida. Here's Governor Ron DeSantis announcing the program at a press conference in 2021.
And it laid out basically a roadmap for what we would be able to do to really help both coastal efforts, but also inland efforts in terms of making Florida more resilient to a lot of the threats we face, particularly from flooding.
A WUFT investigation found the program isn't fully delivering on that promise. Projects in coastal counties have gotten 95% of the program's implementation grant money. That's for projects like upgrading fire stations and stormwater systems. Projects in Miami-Dade County alone have gotten nearly $458 million, over 5 times more than projects in all inland counties combined.
You know, Florida's peninsula, we're surrounded by water.
This is Anna Escamani. She represents Orange County in the Florida House of Representatives.
So I understand the emphasis on coastal communities when it comes to rising sea level, but no one is immune to it.
And that includes the city of Longwood, just north of Orlando. It applied to Resilient Florida twice to relocate its fire station because of severe flood risks. And twice, Resilient Florida turned it down without giving Longwood any feedback. WUFT obtained records showing staff rejected the application because of, quote, insufficient documentation to identify flood risk.
It's getting more and more competitive.
Amanda Boone helps communities apply for Resilient Florida.
Having a good project is not hard. Articulating that to a grantor that's not familiar with the local jurisdiction is a little more difficult.
Boone works for an engineering firm that local governments hire to manage their projects. Smaller inland communities may lack the staff to submit competitive grant proposals, she said, or not have enough money to meet cost share requirements.
But there is a intense need across the state, and you're going to continue to see major applications for implementation grants. Hopefully the program continues to get funded because there's a strong need.
Back when the program kicked off in 2021, it was allotting $438 million, mostly from federal funds. But Resilient Florida's budget has shrunk by over 60% since then. And yeah, that does make it more competitive for any community, but especially for those inland. Even so, Resilient Florida staff released their implementation project awards last month, and there is one inland community, Newberry, that got a grant. It's the first project in an inland county to get funded in 2 years. In Gainesville, I'm Rose Schnabel.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Regan McCarthy. Finally this week, for the first time, Florida high schoolers can satisfy both their physical education and arts requirements through marching band. That's after a new law went into effect in July. WLRN's Sophia Zaran takes us to Flanagan High School in Pembroke Pines, where the award-winning marching band is grateful that their hard work is being recognized in their academics.
In marching band, there's no room for interpretation. That's what we learned while watching the Falcon Sound, a competitive high school marching band in Broward County, practice under the Florida sun. There are many moving parts to an award-winning marching band, so The Falcon Sound's director, Shelby DeVore, explains.
So there's actually four main components of the smart chant. So there's the traditional instruments that you think about. And then we have the drum line, also known as the battery. The color guard, we have one more group, they're inside right now, front ensemble. So those are all the marimbas, xylophones. We have a keyboard, we have a guitar.
Over the summer, the band gathered for 3 weeks for 12-hour days, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. From 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., the students are inside, away from the scorching heat, and spend time focusing on their music. But at 8 a.m., in most spaces at Charles W. Flanagan High School in Pembroke Pines, on this warm Tuesday morning, you can hear the bellowing sound of a metronome.
Like, for example, who's the first tuba?
And that's Will Kobos, the visual tech, instructing the students on their steps and movements. Just last year, they came in third place at a regional Florida Marching Band Championships contest for their piece titled Journey to Oasis. As the students march, dance, and play across the football field, the physical component of this extracurricular becomes more evident. That's why this year, a Florida law went into effect that allows Florida high school students to achieve both their arts and physical education credits at the same time.
They get more resilient every time we see them.
That is Valerie Figueroa Alvarez, the visual caption head for the Falcon Sound. She's been with the marching band for 5 years, overseeing the physical fitness component of the program.
They learn what it means to have grit and be able to push through your comfort zone. So, you know, is something uncomfortable or is it actually pain, right? And I feel like with these kids, every time we come back and we see them, they want to grow and they want to push and they don't want to be comfortable. So that I think is the biggest thing that I notice.
Being one of the top marching bands in Florida means the students see this extracurricular as anything but extra. 16-year-old Hannah Zumbach is going into her junior year at Flanagan and has been doing marching band since middle school.
A lot of people just don't know how much work and physical endurance we have to put into this sport. And we're also, not only are we moving, but we're also playing. So that's definitely, I would say, the arts factor in there. So I think it's pretty cool that they're actually doing this for us.
Zumbach says that thanks to the new law, she'll be using her time in marching band to get her PE credits. DeVore says a change like this has been a long time coming.
They work hard, just as hard as any other sports team does. It definitely opens the door to a lot of, especially for kids who might not be all that interested in sports, but they know that they love band. This gives them an opportunity to be physical and to be healthy while still doing something that they love and making music together.
So whether students want to learn how to dance to the sound of a live band or literally march to the beat of their own drum, academic credit is being given for the effort it takes both physically and artistically to be part of a high school marching band. In Pembroke Pines, I'm Sofia Sarran. WLRN's Sherry Lynn Cabrera helped produce this story.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Randy Vuxta, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Dara Kam, Teddy Byrne, Douglas Soule, and Sophia Zaran. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox. I'm Regan McCarthy. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.